Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I know you might hate to hear it, but we're nearing the end of summer, and as we enter the new school year, we are also inevitably wading back into the great debate about free speech on college campuses. Last week in an interview, for example, Vice President Pence weighed in on this issue. Here he is during an event hosted by Christian conservative nonprofit, the Alliance Defending Freedom.
The freedom of speech is enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution, and we expect our institutions of learning to respect that and respect diverse views on our campuses. I must tell you, I feel somewhat encouraged of the courageous stand that we've seen young people taking on campuses around the country, challenging these, what do they call them, safe zones that emerged. Challenging speech codes that have emerged on campus. All of those things are antithetical to the process of learning.
So courage on campus is challenging safe zones. You meant safe spaces, but close enough. With me now is someone who, as a major university president, has to navigate the debate in the real world and has now written a book about it. Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University, and he's the author now of Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. Thanks for coming on, President Roth. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So the title there is Safe Enough Spaces. Why safe enough?
Well, it's a play on the old psychoanalytic notion of the good enough parent, you know, the parent who didn't make you crazy. The parent who tries to be perfect is actually going to screw up their kids by working too hard to prevent anything bad from happening to their child will naturally lead bad things to happen to the child. The parent who doesn't care a hoot about safety and says go out and play in traffic is also going to be problematic. So you want a parent or a university to provide some safety so that people can navigate the challenges of their environment, but just safe enough so that they can also feel uncomfortable, they can also deal with disagreement, they can also learn how to transform themselves in relation to opposing points of views and new problems and opportunities.
So those are some of the tensions that inform the values on either side of this. Also in your title is the term political correctness, and you devote a chapter in the book to it called The Use and Abuse of Political Correctness. Just first, how do you define political correctness?
Well, political correctness is an interesting concept. It started being used really in the period between the two world wars when leftists especially were accused of not engaging in politics according to the dictates of a theory. But then when I was in college and then as a young professor, people would joke about not wanting to be too politically correct, meaning that they wanted to be more rebellious in their political action and their political activities. But in the last 20 years or so, especially since the 1990s, political correctness has been weaponized by the right to describe what people imagine as groupthink on college and university campuses, that there is this embrace of progressive values in such a way as to make it impossible for anyone to disagree with anyone else. And I think that's really a caricature of what goes on most college and university campuses.
Listeners, first priority on the phones with Wesleyan President Michael Roth will go to current college students or anyone who graduated within the last 5 years, let's say. What has your experience been with the free speech versus hate speech or any related question as we're discussing it now, or react to anything President Roth is saying here, or tell us where you fall on this argument around speech on campus? What about trigger warnings? Do you think that anyone should be allowed to lecture on campus if they have a sponsoring organization? Or do you think we need to regulate who's allowed to come and talk? That's another aspect of this. Any current college student, undergrad, or grad student or if you graduated in the last 5 years. We can also take calls from current faculty. How do you navigate these waters? How are they presenting themselves, these tensions, in your class? If you've been teaching for a long time, has this changed? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Wesleyan University President Michael Roth, author now of Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses, 212-433-9692. You describe an op-ed published at Wesleyan in 2015 about Black Lives Matter that angered a lot of students. Can you tell us that story and why you chose that one as a breakout anecdote to describe, quote, political correctness on campus?
Yeah, it was a op-ed in the campus newspaper that was critical of Black Lives Matter movement in respect to its labeling of police officers in general as dangerous for citizens of color. And once the op-ed appeared, there was a great deal of animated discussion on campus, and there were some protests, and then there were calls for the newspaper to become more diverse, but also calls for the newspaper to be defunded. And that resulted in an enormous amount of attention being placed on the so-called issue of free speech at Wesleyan and with this newspaper. For me, it was an interesting lesson because I saw the students go through these phases of outrage, debate, trying to find a solution to protect freedom of speech. They had said, well, let us be funded by a wealthy patron, and then we don't have to worry about getting defunded. It didn't take too long for them to realize that then they would be dependent on wealthy patrons, mm-hmm. like many radio stations, let's say, or even the Washington Post. They realized that in order to protect free speech, they had to protect editorial autonomy. And that meant that they should have the right to publish articles that are offensive, and they should have the ability to sponsor debates about offensive arguments and disturbing points of view. And I think they got there, actually. At the same time, I wrote a piece saying Black Lives Matter, so does free speech, that created some more debate on campus. And around that time, Jelani Cobb, a columnist now for The New Yorker, wrote a piece about how free speech talk is often a cover for racism. So I invited Professor Cobb to come to Wesleyan and to make that argument. And for the students, that was revelatory because they heard Professor Cobb, who disagreed with President Roth, with me, because he was thinking sometimes free speech talk is just a cover for racism. And I invited him to come and make that argument. And he and I had a great discussion. And doesn't mean we agree with one another now, but we were productive interlocutors. And I think for the students, they recognize that disagreement is what leads to productive discussion and interesting growth in ideas.
But is there a line for you as a college president when, quote, free speech really is a cover for racism?
Absolutely.
And do you have a responsibility to do something about that?
Absolutely. So in this book, Safe Enough Spaces, I spend a great deal of time on the transition from talk about affirmative action and who gets into universities and colleges and on what grounds to talk about inclusion. That is, once you have a diverse student body, it's your obligation as a professor or as an administrator to make sure that those students get the most out of their education. And if you invite to campus people who demean, intimidate, or harass those students, you're not contributing to their education. You're not really defending free speech. What you're doing is creating a hostile environment where education can't take place. And so it is a constant effort for faculty and administrators to figure out what kind of disagreement is productive. And I don't think just depending on some general notion of a marketplace of ideas or pure procedures that everybody can say whatever they want. I don't think that works. We all draw the line somewhere, and I draw the line at intimidation and harassment of my students, which I will not tolerate on our campus.
So people will define intimidation and harassment differently.
Of course, and they'll define speech differently. The Supreme Court has defined speech in such a way that corporations can give unlimited amounts of money to political candidates because it's a function of their freedom of speech. There will be people who use the idea of freedom of speech to defend their right to construct guns with 3D printers. That doesn't mean that we have to accept these slippery slope arguments that any limitation on speech means you're going to tend towards authoritarianism. There is always a limitation on speech. Right. And at a college and university, the limitation should be in the service of education, not in the service of ideology.
Let's take a phone call. Francis in Danbury, Connecticut. You're on WNYC. Hi, Francis.
Good morning. And I just was telling your person that I went back to school at 65. And I go here to Western Connecticut. And I've seen directly what the professor is talking about. And I actually wrote a paper on how cautious teachers need to be and how much they have to tell people that if there's any bad words, anything that makes you not feel comfortable, it really permeates, whereas when I went to school at 18 in 1972, teachers yelled.
Francis, thank you very much. So Francis brings up, without using the term, trigger warnings. And I see from your book that you don't use the term trigger warnings. Why not?
Well, I just think it alludes to a very simplistic notion of what creates traumatic experiences for students. On the other hand, I do really believe that there's nothing wrong as a teacher in preparing students for the material that you're going to be presenting. I teach courses that deal with the representation of genocide, of child abuse, of sexual assault, and I want my students to be prepared to encounter these very challenging and difficult materials. And so I see nothing wrong with warning them, if that's the word we want to use, that what they're going to be doing is working with material that really cuts quite deep.
Now, and could be traumatic for them personally, depending on their life experiences?
Yeah, it could be very troubling for them personally, depending on their life experiences, and in some cases, even traumatic. That doesn't mean they can't learn from it. On the contrary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that people want to go to classes where they learn things that really matter to them. And if they've been experiencing racism, or if they've been experiencing sexual assault, or they have family members who are in the military and they want to understand the pressures of violence contemporary military conflict, then they should be prepared to encounter those things. The idea of a trigger warning isn't to say you shouldn't study this stuff. Mm-hmm. The idea is to simply alert students to the fact that, given their various different backgrounds, they'll have a variety of reactions to challenging materials that we want our students to grapple with.
Or might choose to avoid some things that they would find too disturbing?
Well, some people choose to avoid math, and some people choose to avoid foreign languages. And it certainly will be the case that some people will choose to avoid a course that's centered on sexual assault because of their experience with sexual assault. They should be given that opportunity. Mm-hmm. But I find when I tell my students that we're about to read texts that deal with, let's say, rape, that I don't have students rushing to the door. But I have students who are more prepared to deal with a memoir by a rape survivor than they would have otherwise been.
Julie in Montclair, you're on WNYC with the president of Wesley and Michael Roth. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So I see you just graduated from Oberlin. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And what do you want to add to this?
Well, this broadcast actually brought up something I think about a lot on Oberlin's campus, which is cancel culture. Cancel culture, I would say, emerged on campus from this desire at Oberlin to create spaces that reduce harm to students. But I would say, in exchange, what it accidentally does is often isolate students without those students really understanding what they've done wrong.
What was an example of it? Do you have one?
Yeah, I would say examples generally. I don't want to give a very specific example because of cancel culture itself, actually, but examples include I suppose what I would consider to be casual racism, people, or casual sexism, people making remarks often on the internet or in campus publications that were offensive. And instead of being called in by the community to understand how they were causing harm, oftentimes the students were what we called canceled.
Thank you for that, Julie. I'm going to go right on to Brian in Newark. You're on WNYC, who I think is a recent UVA grad. Hi, Brian.
Hi, it's Ryan.
Ryan, I apologize.
Really, yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm biased towards seeing names as Brian. I don't know why. Go ahead.
Right, there's a bias there. Yeah, so I did graduate from UVA last year, and I think that the previous caller has a very good point. There's, I would say I tend slightly towards, you know, more liberal views, and I think most colleges kind of fall that way. UVA, which is in the South, or, you know, that's open to interpretation depending on where you draw the line.
Yeah,
but most would say it's in the South. Even on that campus, there's kind of, although the administration never forces any sorts of limitations on students, there's definitely a culture where people feel scared to speak up if they feel that they're in a huge minority. And there's a disparity of conservative views. And if you're that, you know, I don't know, one in four, one in five persons that has that view, you feel that there's an environment where you'll get kind of shamed by other students sometimes for speaking up. And it's gotten to the point now that we've had, so, you know, Charlottesville has had a interesting past in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And one of our students was one of the main organizers of that rally. And when he wanted to speak at the school, you had students that wanted to ban him from even coming mm-hmm. to speak.
And do you think,
so I think that we've gotten to the point now where free speech, which is one of the you know, the basic tenets of U.S. society, is being limited in one of the places where, like our mm-hmm. your caller, mm-hmm. Wesleyan President has said, should be encouraging students to have those arguments with each other.
The most. Brian, thank you so much. And President Roth, we've got about a half a minute. You want to reflect on the two callers, recent
sure.
grads we just heard from?
Sure. I mean, I do think cancel culture and the production of outrage is something that is not a typical list of college campuses. It's typical of our country's politics right now. And anything we can do to limit outrage and turn it into productive conversation, which includes increasing intellectual diversity, increasing the representation of conservative voices on campus. But it's our job as educators to not let people just cancel each other, but to help them listen to each other. And that happens more in colleges and universities than it happens in many neighborhoods right. in New York or in many other parts of the country. But we have to work at it. We need to protect free speech. We also need to protect our students.
Good luck with this and everything in the new school year. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University. His new book is called Safe Enough Spaces.